Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this weekend edition of our English feature program. Today you can hear Jill Bevilacqua's reflections for this week's Gospel reading entitled There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. That's followed by Joan Knows with our regular guest Joan Lewis, who'll be bringing us up to date with all that's been happening here in the Vatican over the past 7 days. We begin today's programme then with the Gospel for this 13th Sunday in Ordinary Time, read to us by Sean Patrick Lovett.
When Jesus had crossed back to the other side of the Sea of Galilee in the boat, a large crowd gathered around him, and he stayed close to the lake. One of the officials of the synagogue, a man named Jairus, came near. Seeing Jesus, he fell at his feet and made this earnest appeal. "My little daughter is critically ill. Please come and lay your hands on her so that she may get well and live." The two went off together, and a large crowd followed, pushing against Jesus. People from the official's house arrived, saying, "Your daughter is dead. Why bother the teacher further?" Jesus disregarded the report that had been brought and said to the official, "Fear is useless. What is needed is trust." He would not permit anyone to follow him except Peter, James, and James's brother, John. As they approached the house of the synagogue leader, Jesus was struck by the noise of people wailing and crying loudly on all sides. He entered and said to them, "Why do you make this din with your wailing? The child is not dead. She is asleep." At this they began to ridicule him. Then he put them all out. Jesus took the child's father and mother and his own companions and entered the room where the child lay. Taking her hand, he said to her, "Talitha cum," which means, "Little girl, get up." The girl, a child of 12, stood up immediately and began to walk around. At this the family's astonishment was complete. He enjoined them strictly not to let anyone know about it, and told them to give her something to eat.
Today's Gospel features one of the most familiar of our Lord's miracles, a much-recounted event, it can hardly be called an episode, which was, however, only one of a succession of miracles, of miraculous events or happenings which took place on that extraordinary day. If, that is, we go by Mark's account. And as Mark was writing for Peter, we may take it, why not, for gospel. Jesus had been preaching since early morning from Peter's boat. And as evening approaches, he suggests they cross over to the other side of the lake, which they do. But exhausted as he doubtless was after a day's preaching, Jesus falls asleep almost immediately. For the next we hear is of a storm blowing up and the boat in danger of sinking. The terrified fishermen shake the sleeping Jesus awake, and in no time at all he has calmed the storm and his companions, who, filled with awe, as Mark recounts, say to one another, "Who can this be?" They've barely disembarked on the eastern side of the lake when a man with an unclean spirit appears, indeed with more than one, for he declares, "There are many of us." And as we know, in exchange for inhabiting the body of the man, the legion of demons beg Jesus to send them into a herd of pigs feeding on the mountainside. And all 2,000 of them hurtle down the cliff and plunge into the sea. The man is cured, but the disciples are given no time to recover from this second spectacular event, for the locals don't want this wonder worker to linger among them. And so, back across the lake they go. And, as we read in Luke,
"On his return, Jesus was welcomed by the crowd, for they were all there waiting for him."
And Mark writes,
"When Jesus had crossed again in the boat to the other side, a large crowd gathered round him, and he stayed by the lakeside."
And now the personality of today's gospel makes his appearance. A personality, clearly, for he's mentioned by name and described as one of the rulers of the synagogue, or, as in today's version, one of the officials, one of the heads of the synagogue elsewhere. Perhaps a large synagogue, as the one at Capernaum seems to have been, would have had more than one head. A biblical scholar explains,
Archisynagogos is a Greek title which was widespread among the Jews in Roman times and known also to the pagans. The head of the synagogue might be elected or nominated by an authority. In some cases, the post was hereditary. His role was that of spiritual and practical leader of the community. He it was who chose those persons charged with reading the law and reading the prayers. He saw to the building or restoration of the synagogue.
In a manual on daily life in Bible times, we read,
"The chief function of the synagogue was to foster understanding and proper observance of the Jewish law. In effect, it became the seat of a spiritual government, which ordered and disciplined the lives of the people. Only certain persons were permitted to lead in worship."
The reading and the prayers in common were supervised by the ruler of the synagogue. The sermon might be given by a member of the congregation. And so, despite the late hour, for if we remember, Jesus and the disciples had gone across the lake when the day was already declining, despite this, the crowds are all around him. But then there's a murmur and a slight drawing back of those nearest to Jesus. "Oh, look who it is!" One can imagine the whispers going round. Matthew writes,
"While he was speaking to them, up came one of the officials, who bowed low in front of him and said, 'My daughter has just died, but come and lay your hand on her and her life will be saved.' Jesus rose and with his disciples followed him."
In Mark's version, and similarly in Luke's, we read that the man came up, or came near, and seeing Jesus, fell at his feet. In normal circumstances, a man of importance such as Jairus was would very probably have only bowed. But this man has a beloved daughter who is dangerously ill, if not already dead, and he is not going to stand on his dignity if there's the slightest chance that this stranger could save her life. And so, regardless of the people who, on seeing this august personage, have automatically made way for him, he throws himself at the feet of Jesus and pleads with him earnestly to come and lay his hands on her so that she may get well and live. In the various versions of Mark and Luke, the child is critically ill, desperately sick, at the point of death, dying. If for Matthew the girl was already dead, there would seem to be a discrepancy when we compare the accounts. But more probably he's less concerned with the details and development of the situation and goes straight to the climax, while including also another happening recounted by Mark and Luke. But first things first. What of Jairus? What kind of man is he? We're not told anything of him, except what his words and actions reveal. A loving father, in dire distress, fearful of losing his only daughter, as Luke tells us she was. Any man who loves or has loved a daughter will be able to understand this man's anguish. The relationship between father and daughter is a very special one. For a man, the birth of a daughter is a precious event. This fragile creature he holds in his arms, he knows to be only lent to him. For some day she will almost certainly belong to another man. But for now she is his own, and he formulates wishes, prayers, blessings, as these lines from A Prayer for My Daughter by W.B. Yeats.
May she be granted beauty, and yet not beauty to make a stranger's eye distraught, or hers before a looking-glass. For such, being made beautiful overmuch, consider beauty a sufficient end. Lose natural kindness, and maybe the heart-revealing intimacy that chooses right, and never find a friend. In courtesy, I'd have her chiefly learned. Hearts are not had as a gift, but hearts are earned by those that are not entirely beautiful. May she become a flourishing hidden tree, that all her thoughts may like the linnet be, and have no business but dispensing round their magnanimities of sound. Or may she live like some green laurel, rooted in one dear perpetual place.
Looking through old family mementos, I came across a letter written by my father to my mother, enclosed in a box with a baby's gold bracelet. The occasion was, I think, my first birthday. This is what he wished for his daughter.
Health and happiness and the gift of making true friends. beauty, and a sense of proportion to balance it, courage, and a keen perception of humour to help her over the rough spots, loyalty, and the charm that inspires devotion.
The letter ended with what he wished for most of all, that she would grow up with the qualities he loved most in her mother. And this is another aspect of what a father may feel for a daughter, a desire that she should reflect what he loves in her mother. Some of these thoughts surely passed through the mind of Jairus as he ran from his house in Capernaum down to the lake where the crowds were gathered, and where, someone said, the prophet from Nazareth had just stepped off a fisherman's boat. He had healed men and women, surely he would heal a child. And as he blurted out his frantic appeal, Jairus looked up into the eyes of Jesus and believed. No words were spoken by Jesus. There was no time to waste. He simply went with him, we read. The two went off together, today's version has it. And a large crowd followed, pushing against Jesus. Away from the lake now and up into the town of Capernaum, crowd following, pushing and shoving, trying to get closer and inevitably slowing progress. They were pressing all round him, almost stifling Jesus as he went, writes Luke. But before they're anywhere near the house of Jairus, there's an unexpected halt. A woman who has suffered from a hemorrhage for 12 years touches the cloak of Jesus and is instantly cured. "Who touched me?" exclaims Jesus, turning round. "You see how the crowd is pressing round you, and yet you say, 'Who touched me?'" protest the disciples, reasonably enough. But Jesus continues to look round to see who it was, for, we read, he was immediately aware that power had gone out from him. The woman shows herself and tells her story. "Your faith has restored you to health," Jesus tells her. Not, he implies, the physical contact with his garment. The last thing he wants is to be taken for a magician. Knowing that he's needed at a deathbed, we might wonder why Jesus stops and talks to the woman when it seems that the miracle has taken place anyway. But it is evidently not to be kept secret. And there is a connection, write the scholars, between this extraordinary happening and the one which is to follow. Faith is the link between them. Faith will be the reason for the fourth miraculous event in this miracle-studied day. In his preaching that morning, writes the Bible scholar, Jesus had announced the coming of the kingdom in parables. The four miracles represent the power of the kingdom in action. Having dismissed the woman with a blessing, "Go in peace," Jesus is about to move on. For, clearly anxious, Jairus is probably already walking ahead. But there are people running towards them and shouting, and now they accost Jairus with devastating news. They have just come from his house.
"Your daughter has died. Do not trouble the master any further."
There must have been a moment's horrified silence, even from the crowd. And Jairus? We can imagine the effect of this brutal communication. But also surely a glance at the man in whom he has placed his trust. And that trust will not be betrayed, for Jesus has heard the news and hastens to reassure the distraught Jairus.
"Do not be afraid, only have faith,"
writes a scholar.
Faith in Jesus must persist even when there is no hope and all is over, humanly speaking. Then it is no longer enough to trust in a miracle-working healer, but in one who has the divine power of overcoming death.
Humanly speaking, Jairus must have had at least flickers of doubt, of despair. He must have felt the helplessness that every human being feels when unable to do anything to save the one he loves. Like the helpless grief in these lines from Charlotte Mew's poem, "To a Child in Death."
"You would have scoffed if we had told you yesterday. Love made us feel, or so it was with me, like some great bird, trying to hold and shelter you in its strong wing. A gay little shadowy smile would have tossed us back such a solemn word. And it was not for that you were listening, when so quietly you slipped away, with half the music of the world unheard. What shall we do with this strange summer meant for you? Dear, if we see the winter through, what shall be done with spring? This is the victory of the grave. Here is death's sting. That is not strong enough, our strongest wing." Thank you.
Jairus held on to his hope, to his faith, and at last they reach his house. And Jesus now asserts his authority and refuses to allow anyone to follow him into the house except the three chosen disciples, Peter, James and John, and the child's parents. Jairus, of course, is with him anyway, and the mother must have been on the doorstep waiting, grieving, for her husband's return after what must seem to her to have been a fruitless mission. Everyone else, relations and professional mourners as there no doubt were, is making a horrendous din, weeping and wailing unrestrainedly, writes Mark. Matthew mentions the flute players, and a note on the commotion tells us that this was the loud wailing of the Oriental mourner. Jesus immediately intervenes.
Why all this commotion and crying? The child is not dead, she's asleep. But they laughed at him, so he turned them all out.
One is reminded of the scene at the temple when he overturned the tables of the money changers and drove them out of his father's house. Here he is again in charge, and no one dares to challenge him.
And taking with him the child's father and mother and his own companions, he went into the place where the child lay.
The child. In the older versions, such as the Vulgate, we have maid and damsel, for the girl was 12 years old, and this, as the scholars remind us, was, for a girl, the moment of maturity. She was considered ready for marriage and to become a mother. This reported fact, together with the note that she was an only daughter, makes the prospect of death more dramatic. In the modern translations, however, the words child and little girl are used. Jairus himself refers to her as his little daughter. And so the final scene in this drama is played out, with Jesus taking the child by the hand and speaking the celebrated words, "Little girl, I say to thee, arise." Talitha kum, or kumi, a word, we're told, still used by the Arabs for get up. Jesus, as we know, spoke in Aramaic, and Mark quotes him in this language on more than one occasion. Commenting on the declaration of Jesus that the child is not dead but is sleeping, the scholars write that, in the eyes of the evangelists, Jesus has come to transform death into a sleep from which he wakes us. The Greek verb for get up also means wake up, and transforms this miracle into a solemn sign of the resurrection. He reveals then his Easter power to give life beyond death. Talitha kumi, little girl, I tell you to get up. These words of Jesus are precious historical memory, writes one scholar. Finally, when the child gets up and walks about, to the amazement of all present, there is the ultimate touch of humanity in the recommendation that she be given something to eat. Two last thoughts from the scholars. First, remembering both Jairus and the woman with the hemorrhage.
Nearly always, the Lord worked his miracles because of the compassion which human suffering aroused in him.
Secondly, regarding his instruction that no one should be told what he had done.
From the beginning, Jesus did not desire to declare himself as Messiah, for that would have caused a popular movement or a political character. Later, he wished little by little to reveal himself to the people as the Son of God. For this reason, he ordered them not to let this miracle be known.
But Matthew concludes that the news spread all round the countryside.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And now our regular Vatican watcher Joan Lewis is here to take a look back at Pope Benedict's activities over the past week, beginning with the inauguration of the Year of the Priest by the Pope in St. Peter's Basilica on Friday, June the 19th.
That was a very beautiful and moving ceremony. Of course, it was Vespers in St. Peter's Basilica, and the Pope had, I believe it was March, when he announced that he was going to, there would be this Year for Priests. It would begin on the Feast of the Sacred Heart, which was June 19th, and it will end on the very same feast next year, which I think is June 11th or something like that.
And it's also marking the 150th anniversary,
right,
isn't it, of the birth
of the Curé of Ars.
This interesting figure who's a model for priests today.
Exactly, Jean-Marie Vianney. And the interesting thing is the Bishop of Belle-Ars was in Rome, and he brought a relic of the saintly pastor, and so he brought the heart, and the Pope venerated it. It was brought to the Chapel of the Canons, or the, also called the Choir Chapel.
In the Basilica.
In the Basilica. It's on the left-hand side, a very big chapel as you're walking down towards the front of, towards the altar in St. Peter's Basilica. So the Pope first did that, and a very beautiful homily. His letter was so beautiful. I dedicated my whole blog to that letter.
The letter to priests.
To the letter to priests, which had come out a day earlier. And you know what I did? I asked my readers, I suggested that they print this out, the letter, and handwrite a note and give it to their pastor or some priest in their life is very important. And I said, write me back and tell me the reaction. And I can't tell you how wonderful it was, how many people were inspired by that. And I did the same thing in Rome.
This is your own blog. There's also an interesting new website, isn't there, for the Year of the Priest, available in several
different
languages.
Oh, that's wonderful. It's called annussacerdotalis.org, and it's in six languages, the typical six languages of Vatican documents. So English, French, Italian, Spanish, German, and Portuguese. And it's done by the Congregation for Clergy. So you've got the Pope's letter. You have, obviously, his beautiful remarks at Vespers saying what the mission of priests is, what priests should be, and so forth. And how much more special in life, even with its joys and difficulties, a man ordained to holy orders, you know, should be. And a prayer life is what will help him get through these difficulties. The Pope could not mention that enough, and I think we'll hear a lot of that this year. But the website is great. It has the biography and message of the Curé of Ars, Saint Vianney, the lives of holy priests, a section of prayers for priests and teachings of the fathers of the church and the magisterium on various theological topics. And as I said, it's in all these languages. And it allows priests to receive a newsletter with articles of interest and information for personal formation. So anyone listening who wants to tell their pastor about this, in the unlikely event he doesn't know, you know.
A lot of initiatives coming up, aren't there, on this?
Cardinal Hummes, who heads the Congregation for Clergy, he asked the priest and all those who are part of his parish and everything to live this year with joy, live it with enthusiasm, come up with these initiatives. And I have to tell you, last night I went to a mass celebrating the 40th anniversary, 50th, and 60th anniversary of three different priests. It was so 150 years of priesthood between these three men. And we have to pray, too, because you reflect on the need for vocations, certainly in Western.
It will be very much a focus this year, won't it?
Yes, it will be, indeed.
While we're looking ahead to this upcoming year of priests, of course, we're also about to mark the closing of the Pauline year that has just about completed, and that'll be another big event Sunday and Monday here in the Vatican.
Right, well, and Sunday will be the 28th will be the actual closing of the year of St. Paul, which has had a lot of wonderful initiatives, and I know many people, such as myself, took pilgrimages in the footsteps of St. Paul. And then, again, just looking forward for a second, because we'll talk about it next week, the pallium will be bestowed. I don't know the exact number at this point.
Neither do I. The new Metropolitan Archbishops have
right,
been appointed recently.
And I know there's five from the United States. So
your friend Monsignor Dolan
from New York, and Archbishop Carlson, and Lucas, and Vigneron from Detroit.
Archbishop Nichols from England.
And exactly, there you go. Sure. It's going to be an amazing Monday in the Vatican, let me tell you.
And the following day, Tuesday, we're looking ahead to the inauguration of the newly restored Pauline Chapel, aren't we? Which is going to be another big event for those who are fans of all things Vatican, the museums, and all these extraordinary art treasures that we have there.
Well, it's going to be a big event, and I think the only sad part of the Pauline Chapel restoration is the fact that it is not on the itinerary for visitors to the Vatican. But it is right across from the Sistine Chapel. If you were to exit at a big door opposite the altar in the Sistine Chapel, you'd be in the Sala Regia, magnificent, and you just walk across the hall and there's the Pauline Chapel. And it got its name because it was Paul III who commissioned this chapel, actually in 1538. And many buildings and rooms in the Vatican take the name of the Pope. So this Paul and Pauline, the Sistine from Sixtus and so forth. The chapel was completed in 1540, and it was intended to be the chapel for the Popes. It was in the Vatican Palace, of course. The Popes knew when it came to actually decorate, if you will, the chapel, they knew they wanted Michelangelo to do work. And he was working on a couple of other things, I think the Sistine Chapel ceiling or something. But anyway, he did the conversion of Paul and the martyrdom of St. Peter. And actually, his contemporaries did not like those works as much as other things. But these are the two major works that have been restored. And so this chapel was actually used not only as the Pope's private chapel, but many, many years earlier for conclaves. So I'm pretty excited because as a patron of the Vatican Museums, we are responsible for that restoration work.
Just looking even further ahead for a moment, we heard this week that the Pope is expected to meet with your president, with U.S. President Barack Obama, who's going to be here for the G8 in July.
Exactly. There's been a lot of back and forth on that with the Vatican and the White House. Not, you know, nobody's saying, listen, the White House hasn't contacted us. Well, they have now. And Obama will be in Italy 8, 9, 10 July, as you said, for the G8 summit in Aquila. And then they asked for an afternoon meeting on the day of the 10th because apparently he had plans to fly to Ghana. And so his meeting with the Pope, I believe, is scheduled to be 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So he'll come after the summit, have his meeting with the Pope, and after that he flies to Ghana with a very late arrival.
Be interesting to see what issues come up on
what do they talk about
in that meeting. Yeah. Very interesting to follow that one.
Exactly.
Just time to take a quick look back. The audience, the general audience this past Wednesday, the Pope had some interesting things to say about children in conflict and the need to protect, in particular, child soldiers. That came as part of his the greetings he often gives at the end of the general audience.
The Holy Father, yes, indeed, at the end of the audience, greeted a delegation headed by Radhika Kumaraswamy, the Undersecretary General of the United Nations and a special representative for children and armed conflict. The Holy Father said, obviously, he thanked her for her efforts and all of her collaborators to defend child victims of violence and arms. And he said, I'm thinking of all the children of the world. But he mentioned a whole list of things. He said, those who suffer fear, abandonment, hunger, abuses, sickness, death. And he said, the Pope is always close to these young victims and remembers them in his prayers. And then the Holy Father also spoke of the Red Cross, because they were founded June 24th. They were founded exactly 150 years ago on June 24th of 1859. So he talked about the Red Cross, their values of universality, neutrality, and independence of service, and then their help in emergency situations too, floods, obviously the earthquake in April in Aquila. And then the Pope ended those remarks and he said, I want to take advantage of this moment to ask for the release of all people held hostage in areas of conflict. And once again, I appeal for the release of Eugenio Vanni, who's a Red Cross worker in the Philippines.
Once again, Jen, thank you so much for being with us. We'll be with you again at the same time next week.
See you then.
Thanks there to our regular guest, Joan Lewis, bringing us to the end of this edition of the English Feature Programme. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.